10. Torgerson and Weems saw the body in the road at the same time. They were both breathing canned air now. Nausea had come on them quickly with frightening power. But with the masks in place, it disappeared completely. Leandro had been right. The air. Something in the air. Claudel Weems had ceased asking questions after they'd picked up the police band squeal from Massachusetts. After that, he only sat with his hands in his lap, his eyes moving steadily and cautiously. Further downtuning had brought them news of police doings in such interesting places as Friday, North Dakota, Arnett, Texas. Torgerson stopped and the two men got out. Weems paused, then took the riot gun clipped under the dash. Torgerson nodded. Things were starting to come clear, not sane, but clear. Gavins and Rhodes had disappeared on their way back from this town, and Monster had been here the day before he committed suicide. What was that Phil Collins song? The one with the spooky drums? I can feel it in the air tonight. It was in the air, all right. Gently, Torgerson turned over the man he believed to be the one who had finally blown the whistle on this craziness. He had cleaned up a lot of ugly messes on the highway, but he still drew in a harsh gasp and shied his face away.
Christ, what hit him?
Weems asked. The mask muffled his words, but the tone of dismay came through loud and clear. Torgerson didn't know. He had seen a man once who'd been hit by a snowplow. That guy had looked a little like this. That was the closest. The guy was blood from the top of what had been his head all the way down to his waist. His belt buckle had been driven deep into his body.
Christ, man. I'm sorry,
he murmured, and laid the body down gently. He could go for the wallet, but he wanted nothing more to do with that smashed body. He headed for the car. Weems fell in beside him, riot gun held on a slant against his chest. In the distance, to the west, the smoke was growing thicker by the moment, but here there was only a faint, woodsy tang.
This is crazy shit,
Weems said through his mask.
Yes.
I have a very bad feeling about being here.
Yes.
I believe we should vacate this area on the... There was a crackling sound from behind them. And for a moment, Torgerson thought it must be the fire. It was far away, relatively speaking, but it could be over here, too. Perfectly reasonable. When you were at the Mad Hatter's tea party, anything was. Turning, he realized that the sound was not burning branches, but breaking them.
Holy shit!
Claudel Weems cried. Torgerson's jaw dropped. The Coke machine, stupid but reliable, moved in again. This time it came out of the brush at the side of the road. The glass display front was broken, the sides of the big rectangular box were scratched, and on the metal part of the machine's front, Torgerson saw a horridly suggestive shape, driven in so deep it looked almost sculpted. It looked like half a head. The Coke machine moved out over the road and just hung there for a moment, like a coffin painted in incongruously gay colors. They were gay, at least, until you noticed the blood which had dripped and run and was beginning to dry in maroon splotches. Torgerson could hear a faint humming and a clicking sound.
Like relays,
he thought.
Maybe it's been damaged.
Maybe.
But still.
The Coke machine suddenly arrowed straight at them.
Motherfucker!
Weems shouted. There was dismay and terror in his voice, but a kind of crazed laughter as well.
Shoot it! Shoot it!
Torgerson cried and leapt to the right. Weems took a step back and promptly fell over Leandro's body. This was extremely stupid. It was also extremely lucky. The Coke machine missed him by inches. As it tanked for another run, Weems sat up and pumped three quick shotgun blasts into it. Metal exploded inward in metal daisy shapes with black centers. The machine began to buzz. It stopped, jittering back and forth in the air like a man with Huntington's chorea. Torgerson drew his service pistol and fired four rounds. The Coke machine started for him, but now it seemed lethargic, unable to get up any speed. It jerked to a stop, jerked forward, stop, jerked forward again. It rocked drunkenly from side to side. The buzzing grew louder. Runnels of soda fell from the access door in sticky rivulets. As it came at him, Torgerson pivoted easily away.
Drop, Andy,
Weems yelled. Torgerson dropped. Claudel Weems shot the Coke machine 3 more times, firing as fast as he could work the pump action. On the 3rd shot, something inside it exploded. Black smoke and a brief belch of fire licked out one side of the machine. Green fire, Torgerson saw. Green. The Coke machine thumped to the road about 20 feet from Leandro's body. It tottered, then fell forward with a hollow bang. Broken glass jingled. There were 3 seconds of silence, then a long, metallic, croaking sound. It stopped. The Coca-Cola machine lay dead across the white line in the middle of Route 9. Its red and white hide was full of bullet holes. Smoke poured from it.
I have just drawn my weapon and killed a Coke machine, sir,
Claudel Weems said hollowly inside his mask. Andy Torgerson turned toward him.
And you never even ordered it to halt or fired a warning shot. Probably draw a suspension, you dumb shit.
They stared at each other over the masks and started to laugh. Claudel Weems laughed so hard he was nearly doubled over.
Green,
Torgerson thought. And although he was still laughing, nothing felt very funny inside where he lived.
The fire that came out of that fucker was green.
Never fired a warning shot,
Weems cackled breathlessly.
No, I never did. Never did at all. Violated its fucking civil right,
Torgerson said.
Have to be an investigation,
Weems laughed.
Yo, baby. I mean...
He tottered on his feet, and there was a lot of Claudel Weems to totter. Torgerson suddenly realized he was dizzy himself. They were breathing pure oxygen, hyperventilating.
Stop laughing,
he shouted, and his voice seemed to come from a long distance away.
Claudel, stop laughing.
He somehow crossed the distance to where Weems was swaying woozily on his feet. The distance seemed very wide. When he was almost there, he stumbled. Weems somehow caught him, and for a moment they stood swaying drunkenly, arms about each other like Rocky Balboa and Apollo Creed at the end of the first fight.
You pulling me down, asshole,
Weems muttered.
But you started it.
The world came into focus, wavered, steadied.
Slow breaths,
Torgerson told himself.
Big, slow breaths. Easy respiration. Be still, my beating heart.
That laugh made him giggle again, but he got hold of it. The 2 of them wavered back toward the cruiser, arms about each other's waist.
The body,
Weems said.
Leave it for now. He's dead. We're not. Yet.
Look, Weems said as they passed Leandro's remains.
The bubs. They're out.
The blue flashers, called bubbles, or bubs by the troopers, on top of the cruiser, were dead and dark. That wasn't supposed to be. Leaving the flashers on at the scene of the accident was ingrained behavior.
Did you?
Torgerson began and then stopped. Something in the landscape had changed. The day had darkened, as it does when a large cloud floats over the sun or when an eclipse begins. They looked at each other, then turned. Torgerson saw at first a great silvery shape emerging from the boil of smoke. Its huge leading edge gleamed.
Holy Christ!
Weems almost squealed. His large brown hand found Torgerson's arm and bore down upon it. Torgerson barely felt it, although there would be bruises in the shape of Weems's hand the next day. Up it came. And up. And up. Smoke hazed sunlight glinted on its silvery metallic surface. It rose on an angle of roughly 40 degrees. It seemed to be wavering slightly, although that could have been an illusion or heat haze. Of course, the whole thing was an illusion. Had to be. No way it could be real, Torgerson thought. It was oxygen rapture.
But how can we both be having the same hallucination?
Oh, my dear God.
Weems groaned.
It's a flying saucer. Andy, it's a fucking flying saucer.
But to Torgerson, it did not look like a saucer. It looked like the underside of an army mess plate, the biggest damn plate in creation. Up it came, and up it came. You thought it must end, that a hazy margin of sky must appear between it and the rafters of smoke, but still it came, dwarfing the trees, dwarfing all the landscape. It made the smoke of the forest fire look like a couple of cigarette butts smoldering in an ashtray. It filled more and more of the sky, blotting out the horizon, rising. Oh, something was rising out of Big Engine Woods, and it was deathly silent. There was no sound. No sound at all. They stared at it. And then Weems clutched Torgerson, and Torgerson clutched Weems. They hugged each other like children, and Torgerson thought,
oh, if it falls on us.
And still it came up from the smoke and the fire, and up, as if it would never end. 11. By nightfall, Haven had been cut off from the outside world by the National Guard. The guardsmen surrounded it, those downwind wearing oxygen equipment. Torgerson and Weems made it out, but not in their cruiser. That was as dead as John Wilkes Booth. They hoofed it. By the time they had used up the oxygen in the last flat pack, swapping it back and forth, they were well into Troy and found themselves able to deal with the outside air. The wind left them lucky, Claudel Weems said later. They walked out of what would soon be referred to as the zone of pollution in top-secret government reports. And theirs was the first official word of what was going on in Haven. But by then there had been hundreds of unofficial reports on the lethal quality of the air in the area, and thousands of reports of a gigantic UFO seen rising from the smoke in Big Engine Wood. Weems made it out with a bloody nose. Torgerson lost half a dozen teeth. Both counted themselves lucky. The initial perimeter, staffed with National Guardsmen from Bangor and Augusta, was thin. By 9 p.m. it had been augmented by guardsmen from Limestone and Presque Isle and Brunswick and Portland. By dawn, 1,000 more battle-equipped guardsmen had been flown in from Eastern Corridor City. Between the hours of 7 p.m. and 1 a.m., NORAD stood at DEFCON 2. The president was circling the Midwest at 60,000 feet in looking glass and chewing Tums 5 and 6 at a time. The FBI was on the scene at 6 p.m., the CIA at 7:15 p.m. By 8 o'clock, they were yelling about jurisdiction. At 9:15 p.m., a frightened, infuriated CIA agent named Spacklin shot an FBI agent named Richardson. The incident was hushed up, but both Gardner and Bobby Anderson would have understood perfectly. The Dallas police were on the scene and in complete control of the situation. Chapter 10. Tommyknockers, knocking at the door. 1. There was a moment of paralyzed silence in Bobby's kitchen following the misfire of Ev Hillman's old .45, a silence that was as much mental as it was physical. Guard's wide blue eyes stared into Bobby's green ones. You tried, Bobby began, and her mind,
tried to,
produced an echo in Gardner's head. That moment seemed very long. And when it broke like glass. Bobby had dropped the photon pistol to her side in her surprise. Now she brought it up again. There was to be no second chance. In her agitation, her mind was completely open to Gardner, and he felt her shock at the chance she had given him. She intended that there should be no second chance. There was nothing he could do with his right hand. It was under the table. Before she could aim the muzzle of the photon pistol at him, he put his left hand on the edge of the kitchen table and, without thinking, shoved as hard as he could. The table leg squealed harshly on the floor as the table moved. It struck Bobby's lumped and misshapen chest. At the same instant, a beam of brilliant green light shot from the barrel of the toy gun hooked into Hank Buck's big radio tape player. Instead of hitting Guard's own chest, it jerked upward and passed over his shoulder, more than a foot above it, actually. But he could still feel the skin there tingle unpleasantly under the shirt, as if the surface molecules were dancing like drops of water on a hot skillet. Guard twisted to the right and dropped down to get away from that beam of what looked like light. His ribs struck the table, struck it hard, and the table rammed Bobby again, this time even harder. Bobby's chair rocked backward on its rear legs, teetered, and then both it and she toppled over with a crash. The beam of green light swung upward, and Gardner was momentarily reminded of those guys who stand on airport tarmacs at night, using powerful flashlights to guide planes into their berths. He heard a low crunching, crackling sound, like splintering plywood from overhead, looked up and saw the photon pistol had drawn a slit in the kitchen ceiling. Gardner staggered to his feet. Incredibly, his jaws cracked and wavered in another yawn. His head clanged and echoed with the grass fire alarm of Bobby's thoughts.
He's got a gun, tried to shoot me, bastard gun, he's got...
And he tried to shield himself before he went mad. He couldn't. Bobby was screaming inside his head, and as she lay on the floor, pinned for the moment between the table and overturned chair, she was trying to bring the gun to bear on him for another shot. Gardner lifted his foot and shoved the table again, grimacing. It overturned, beers, pills, and boombox radio all sliding off. Most of the stuff fell on Bobby. Beer splashed in her face and ran fizzing and foaming over her new and improved skin. The radio hit her neck, then the floor, landing in a shallow puddle of beer.
"Flash, you fucker!" Gardner screamed at it. "Explode! Self-destruct! Explode, goddammit!"
The radio did more than that. It seemed to bulge, and then with a sound like rotten cloth ripping along a seam, it shattered outward in all directions, belching streaks of green fire like bottled lightning. Bobby screamed. What he heard with his ears was bad. The sound inside his head was infinitely worse. Gardner screamed with her, not hearing himself. He saw that Bobby's shirt was burning. He started for her, not thinking about what he was up to. He dropped the .45 as he did so, without even thinking. This time it did go off, sending a slug into Jim Gardner's ankle, shattering it. Pain blew through his mind like a hot wind. He screamed again. He took a shambling step forward, his head ringing with her horrid mental cries. They would send him mad in a moment. This thought was actually a relief. When he finally went mad, none of this shit would matter anymore. Then, for one second, Guard saw his Bobby for the last time. He thought, perhaps, Bobby was trying to smile. Then the screaming began again. She screamed and tried to beat out the flames that were turning her torso to tallow, and that screaming was too much. Far too much, too loud, far too loud. It was unbearable. For them both, he thought. He bent, found the triple-damned pistol on the floor and picked it up. He needed to use both of his thumbs to get it cocked. The pain in his ankle was bad, he knew that. But for the moment it was lost to him, buried under Bobby's shrieking agony. He pointed Hillman's pistol at her head.
"Work, you goddamn thing. Oh, please, please, work."
But if it worked and he missed, there mightn't be another cartridge in the mag. His motherfucking hands wouldn't stop shaking. He fell to his knees like a man struck with a sudden, violent need to pray. He crawled toward Bobby, who lay shrieking and writhing and burning on the floor. He could smell her, could see black shards of plastic from the radio's case bubbling their way into her flesh. He almost overbalanced and fell on top of her. Then he pressed the .45 against the side of her neck and pulled the trigger. Another click. Bobby screaming and screaming, screaming inside his head. He tried to pull the slide back again. Almost got it. Then it slipped. Snick.
"Please, God, oh, please let me be your friend this one last time."
This time he got the slide all the way back. He tried the trigger again. This time the gun went off. The scream suddenly became a loud buzz in Gardner's head. He knew he was listening to the mental sound of mortal disconnect. He turned his head upward. A bright stripe of sunlight from the unzipped roof fell across his face, bisecting it. Gardner shrieked. Suddenly the buzzing stopped and there was silence. Bobby Anderson, or whatever she had become, was as dead as the pile of autumn leaf corpses in the control room of the ship, as dead as the galley slaves which had been the ship's drive. She was dead, and Gardner would have gladly died then too, but it still wasn't over. Not yet. 2. Kyle Archenborg was having a Pepsi in Cooter's when the screams began in his head. The bottle dropped from his hand and shattered on the floor as his hands jerked up to his temples. Dave Rutledge, dozing outside Cooter's in a chair which he had caned himself, was tilted back against the building and dreaming weird dreams in alien colors. His eyes snapped open, and he sat bolt upright as if someone had touched him with a live wire, scrawny tendons standing out on his throat. His chair slid out from under him, and when his head hit the wooden wall of the market, his neck shattered like glass. He was dead before he hit the asphalt. Hazel McCready was making herself a cup of tea. When the screams began, her hands jerked. The one holding the teapot spilled boiling water across the back of the one holding the cup, scalding it badly. She hurled the teapot across the room, screaming in pain and fear. Ashley Raval, riding his bike past the town hall, fell over into the street and lay there stunned. Dick Allison and Newt Berenger were playing cribbage at Newt's house, a pretty goddamn stupid thing to be doing since each knew what the other held in his hand. But Newt didn't have a Parcheesi board, and besides, they were only passing time. Waiting for the telephone to ring, waiting for Bobby to tell them the drunk was dead and the next phase of the work could begin. Newt was dealing, and he sprayed cards all over the table and floor. Dick bolted to his feet, eyes wild, hair standing on end, and lurched for the door. He ran into the wall 3 feet to the right of it instead and went sprawling. Doc Warwick was in his study going over his old diaries. The scream hit him like a wall of cinder blocks being trundled along a set of tracks at brisk speed. His body dumped adrenaline into his heart in lethal quantities, and it blew like a tire. Ad McKean was in his pickup truck, headed over to Newt's. He ran off the road and into Pooch Bailey's abandoned hot dog house. His face hit the steering wheel. He was momentarily stunned, but no more. He had been going slow. He looked around, dazed and terrified. Wendy Fannin was coming up from the cellar with 2 jars of peach preserve. Since her becoming had started, she ate little else. In the last 4 weeks, she had eaten over 90 jars of peach preserves all by herself. She wailed and threw these 2 into the air like a spastic juggler. They came down, struck the stairs, shattered. Peaches and sticky juice ran and dripped. Bobby, she thought numbly, Bobby Anderson's burning up. Nancy Voss was standing blankly at the back window and thinking about Joe. She missed Joe, missed him a lot. She supposed that the becoming would eventually wipe that longing out. Every day it seemed more and more distant. But although it hurt to miss Joe, she didn't want that hurt to stop. It made no sense, but there it was. Then the shrieks began in her head, and she jerked forward so suddenly that she broke 3 of the window panes with her forehead. 3. Bobby's screams blanketed Haven like an air raid siren. Everything and everyone came to a complete stop. And then the changed people of Haven drifted into the streets of the village. Their looks were all one look. Dismay, pain, and horror at first. Then anger. They knew who had caused those shrieks of agony. While they went on, no other mental voice could be heard, and the only thing anyone could do was listen to them. Then came the buzzing death rattle, and a silence so complete, it could only be death. A few moments later, there was the low pulse of Dick Allison's mind. It was emotionally shaken, but clear enough in its command.
Her farm. Everyone. Stop him before he can do anything else.
Hazel's voice picked the thought up, strengthening it. The effect was like a second voice joining a first to make a duet.
Bobby's farm. Go there. Everybody.
The beat of Kyle's mental voice made it a trio. The radius of the voice began to spread as it gained strength.
Everyone, stop him.
Adley's voice. Newt Beringer's voice.
Before he can do anything else.
Those Gardner thought of as the shed people had welded their voices into one voice of command, clear and beyond denial. Not that anyone in Haven even thought of denying it.
Stop him before he can do anything to the ship. Stop him before he can do anything to the ship.
Rosalie Skeen left her kitchen sink without bothering to turn off the water, running over the cod she had been freshening for supper. She joined her husband, who had been in the backyard chopping wood, and who had barely missed amputating several of his toes when Bobby's screams began. Without a word, they went to their car, got in, and started for Bobby's farm, 4 miles away. Turning out of their driveway, they nearly struck Elk Barker, who had taken off from his gas station on his old Harley. Freeman Moss was wheeling his pulp truck. He felt a vague regret. He had sort of liked Gardner. He had what Freeman's pop had called sand, but that wouldn't stop him from tearing the bastard's gizzard up. Andy Bozeman was driving his Oldsmobile Delta 88, his wife sitting beside him with her hands folded neatly on her purse. In it was a molecule exciter which could raise the spot heat of anything 2 inches in diameter, roughly 1,000 degrees, in 15 seconds. She was hoping to boil Gardner like a lobster.
Just let me get within 5 feet,
she kept thinking.
Just 5 feet, that's all I ask.
Beyond that distance, the gadget became unreliable. She knew she could have improved its effectiveness up to 0.5 mile, and now wished she had done so. But if Andy didn't have at least 6 fresh shirts in the closet, he was like a bear. Bozeman himself wore a frozen sneer of rage, lips skinned back from his few remaining teeth in a dry, spitless grin.
I'll whitewash your fence when I get hold of you, fuckface,
he thought, and pushed the olds up to 90, passing a line of slower-moving cars all headed for Bobby's place. They all picked up the command voice, which was now a hammering litany.
Stop him before he can do anything to the ship. Stop him before he can do anything to the ship. Stop him, stop him, stop him!
4. Guard stood over Bobby's corpse, half mad with pain and grief and shock, and abruptly his jaws snapped open in another wide, tendon-stretching yawn. He reeled to the sink, trying to hop but doing a bad job of it because of the load of dope he'd taken on. Each time he came down on the bad ankle, it felt as if there was a metal claw inside him, relentlessly digging. The dryness in his throat was much worse now. His limbs felt heavy. His thoughts were losing their former acuteness. They seemed to be spreading, like broken egg yolks. As he reached the sink, he yawned again and deliberately took a step on the shattered ankle. The pain slashed through the fog like a sharply honed meat cleaver. He barely cracked the tap marked H and got a glass of warm, almost hot water. Fumbled in the overhead cabinet, knocking a box of cereal and a bottle of maple syrup onto the floor. His hand closed around the carton of salt with a picture of the little girl on the front.
When it rains, it pours,
he thought soupily.
That is very true.
He fumbled at the pour spout for what seemed like at least a year, and then spilled enough salt into the glass to turn the water cloudy, stirred it with a finger, chugged it. The taste was like drowning. He retched, bringing up salt water dyed blue. He saw undissolved chunks of blue pills in the vomitus as well. Some looked more or less intact.
How many did she get me to take?
Then he threw up again. Again, again. It was an encore performance of the projectile vomiting in the woods. Some overworked circuit in his brain persistently triggering the gag reflex, a deadly hiccuping that could kill. At last it slowed, then stopped. Pills in the sink. Bluish water in the sink. Blood in the sink. A lot. He staggered backward, came down on the bad ankle, screamed, fell on the floor. He found himself looking into one of Bobby's glazed eyes across the lumpy terrain of the linoleum and closed his own. Immediately his mind began to drift away, but in that blackness there were voices. No, many voices blended into one. He recognized it. It was the voice of the shed people. They were coming for him, as he supposed he had always known they would, in time.
Stop him, stop him, stop him. Get moving or they won't have to stop you. They'll shoot you or disintegrate you or whatever they want to do to you while you're snoozing on the floor.
He got to his knees, then managed to get to his feet with the help of the counter. He thought there was a box of no-dos in the bathroom cabinet, but doubted if his stomach would hold them down after the latest insult he had dealt it. Under other circumstances, it might have been worth the experiment. But Gardner was afraid that if the projectile vomiting started again, it might not stop.
Just keep moving. If it gets really bad, take a few steps on that ankle. That'll sharpen you up in a hurry.
Would it? He didn't know. All he knew was he had to move fast right now, and wasn't sure he would be able to move for long at all. He hopped staggered to the kitchen door and looked back one final time. Bobby, who had rescued Gardner from his demons time after time, was little more than a hulk now. Her shirt was still smoking. In the end, he hadn't been able to save her from hers. Just put her out of their reach.
Shot your best friend. Good fucking deal, huh?
He put the back of his hand against his mouth. His stomach grunted. He shut his eyes and forced the vomiting down before it could start. He turned, opened them again, and started across the living room. The idea was to look for something solid, hop to it, and then hold on to it. His mind kept wanting to be that silver puffer balloon it became just before he was carried away by the big black twister. He fought it as well as he could and marked things and hopped to them. If there was a god and if he was good, perhaps they all would bear his weight, and he would make it across this seemingly endless room like Moses and his troops had the desert. He knew that the shed people would arrive soon. He knew that if he was still here when they did, his goose wasn't just cooked, it was nuked. They were afraid he might do something to the ship. Well, yes, now that you mentioned it, that was part of what he had in mind, and he knew he would be safest there. He also knew he couldn't go there. Not yet. He had business in the shed first. He made it out onto the porch where he and Bobby had sat up late on so many summer evenings, Peter asleep on the boards between them. Just sitting here, drinking beers, the Red Sox playing their nightly nine at Fenway or Comiskey Park or some damn place, but playing mostly inside Bobby's radio. Tiny baseball men dodging between tubes and circuits. Sitting here with cans of beer and a bucket of cold well water. Talking about life, death, God, politics, love, literature. Maybe even once or twice about the possibility of life on other planets. Gardner seemed to remember such a conversation or two. But perhaps that was only his tired mind goofing with him. They had been happy here. It seemed a very long time ago. It was Peter his tired mind fixed on. Peter was really the first goal, the first piece of furniture he had to hop to. This wasn't exactly true. The attempted rescue of David Brown had to come prior to ending Peter's torment. But David Brown did not offer him the emotional pulse point he required. He had never seen David Brown in his life. Peter was different.
Good old Peter,
he remarked to the still hot afternoon. Was it yet afternoon? By God, it was. He reached the porch steps and then disaster struck. His balance suddenly deserted him. His weight came down on the bad ankle. This time he could almost see the splintered ends of the bones digging into each other. Gardner uttered a high mewling shriek, not the scream of a woman, but of a very young girl in desperate trouble. He grabbed for the porch railing as he collapsed sideways. During her frantic early July, Bobby had fixed the railing between the kitchen and the cellar, but had never bothered with the one between the porch and the dooryard. It had been rickety for years, and when Gard put his weight on it, both of the rotted uprights snapped. Ancient wood dust puffed out into the summer sunlight, along with the heads of a few startled termites. Gard pitched sideways off the porch, yelling miserably, and fell into the dooryard with a solid meat thump. He tried to get up, then wondered why he was trying. The world was swaying in front of his eyes. He saw first two mailboxes, then three. He decided to forget the whole thing and go to sleep. He closed his eyes.